Matthew chapter 20, sentences 1 to 19. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire men to work in his vineyard. He agreed to pay them a denarius for the day and sent them into his vineyard. About the third hour he went out and saw others standing in the marketplace doing nothing. He told them, "You also go and work in my vineyard and I'll pay you whatever is right." So they went. He went out again about the sixth hour and the ninth hour and did the same thing. About the 11th hour he went out and found still others standing around. He asked them, "Why have you been standing here all day long doing nothing?" "Because no one has hired us," they answered. He said to them, "You also go and work in my vineyard." When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, "Call the workers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last ones hired and going on to the first." The workers who were hired about the 11th hour came and each received a denarius. So when those came who were hired first, they expected to receive more. But each one of them also received a denarius. When they received it, they began to grumble against the landowner. "These men who were hired last worked only 1 hour," they said, "and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the work and the heat of the day." But he answered one of them, "Friend, I am not being unfair to you. Didn't you agree to work for a denarius? Take your pay and go. I want to give the man who was hired last the same as I gave you. Don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? Or are you envious because I am generous? So the last will be first, and the first will be last." Now as Jesus was going to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside and said to them, "We are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will turn him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. On the third day, he will be raised to life."
Well, friends, good evening. It's nice to see you this Sunday night. And if you are joining us tonight for the first time, perhaps visiting us, let me introduce myself. My name is Dominic. I'm the pastor of this church. Well, here we are, beginning of the year. Some of us, it's first week back from holidays. Some of us, it's second week back from Christmas. And tomorrow, I start work after holidays. And, in a sense, we've been back for a week because of our planning conference last week. But really, it's hit the desk tomorrow to start thinking about all the things that we've got to do. And I've checked my diary, looking the next fortnight. And here is my mission for me for the next 14 days. As I hit my desk tomorrow morning and I realised I've been away last week, then on holidays before that, then I was back a week and then we were off in Bathurst. I've been away 5 weeks out of the last 6 weeks. And so I have got so many emails to reply to. In fact, I got an email yesterday from somebody saying, "Why haven't you replied to my email from the 29th of November? And so I've got a zillion tons of correspondence, and then I've got we want to start organising this Bible teaching meeting in Piemont, and so I've got to pave the streets of Piemont, working out the different media outlets, working out where we could place that meeting over the next, really we've got to make a decision next week so we could start it in early February, and then we've got a supporters supper happening on Thursday night for Sam Russell, and there's the leaders meeting on Saturday morning. We got church again next Sunday. I'm speaking at three things on Wollongong the following week. I had a busy, you may listen to all of that and you might think, that's not much. Or you might think, that's a lot. I got to work through getting in contact with Leichhardt Council because we got our building application in, and I got a stack of stuff. Now, after church tonight, we could sit down over the pub, we could have a conversation, we could talk about the things that you've got on the next fortnight, and we could tell each other the stories of what we've each got on, and then at the end of that, we'd kind of put it out of our mind, forget it, and move on. Jesus was heading down the road to Jerusalem. And lots of people were heading down the road to Jerusalem at this time because it's a fortnight before Passover. And so Passover, in the year 33 AD, it was the 3rd of April. And so we're probably looking the second last week of March. And Jesus is heading with his disciples and thousands of other people up to Jerusalem for the Passover festival. As they're going, Jesus pulls aside his 12 top guys and said to them, "Guys, here's what's going to happen the next 14 days I want to be clear about this so that nobody's under any miscomprehension. This is what we're doing. This is where we're going the next 14 days. So pick it up with me, the two, three sentences we're going to look at tonight. Matthew chapter 20, it's sentence 17. Jesus was going up to Jerusalem. He took the 12 disciples aside and said to them, "We're going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They'll condemn him to death and will turn him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. And on the third day he'll be raised to life." Now how do you react to what Jesus is saying there? I mean, how would you have reacted if put yourself in the mindset of being one of the disciples, one of the 12 disciples. Just imagine you're in that group of, you're there walking, you're 25 k's away from Jerusalem, and you say, "Hey guys, I want to have a quiet chat." And he pulls the 12 of you aside and you sit down and he says, "I've got something to tell you." It's good for us tonight to stop and think about these words of Jesus. Week by week at church, we look at all sorts of aspects of what God has done. We look at all sorts of aspects of what God will do. Today we pause. Today we stop. Today we listen to Jesus as he spells out his mission of what he's going to do in that next 14 days. And I put it to you that just say I went back on holidays tomorrow morning and sat another 14 days away. Look, in the big picture it wouldn't make any difference. You went on holidays tomorrow morning and you missed 2 weeks of work, whatever. In the big picture it wouldn't make any difference. But Jesus, the next 14 days, it changes the world forever. You might be new here, checking us out, checking out what is Christianity, checking it out, what is Jesus on about? Tonight, we're not looking at a tangent. We're not looking at a side issue of Christianity. We are looking right at the centre of what this church stands for. Right at the centre of what this ministry stands for. Right at the centre of what is biblical Christianity. But tonight, it's not a night to kind of shrug your shoulders and move on. Tonight is a night to say to Jesus, "If that is true, then my life must change." So here we go. A little bit of background just before we hit the passage. Last Sunday, remember, we looked at the passage immediately before this one in the Bible, and we saw Jesus tell an extraordinary story. But to get the context for the whole thing, a man comes to Jesus in Matthew chapter 19, and I'm back in sentence 16. Just grab that, lock eyes on that, we'll get context. "Good teacher," he says to Jesus, "what must I do to inherit eternal life? How can I be sure of getting to heaven?" And Jesus points him to the Ten Commandments. He points out that he's not able to follow the commandments. And Jesus says, "Go give up everything and then come follow me." And the bloke says, "That's impossible. And it's very hard to give up everything." And then Jesus, having established that the bloke is unacceptable to heaven, shows him how God moves beyond justice to generosity. The story was the man employed people during the day. He employed some people at 6 a.m. Then he employed some workers at 9 a.m. Then at midday. Then at 3 p.m. Then at 5 p.m. And then it came pay time at the end of the day. And he generously doesn't treat them as they deserve, but generously goes beyond what they deserve. And we saw last time that the man in Jesus' story was God. And last week we saw the heart of God. Extraordinary generosity. We saw that beyond justice, God is generous. God's not about shortchanging people. He's not about shortchanging you, me. God is richly, amazingly generous. Gives us far more than we deserve. And then just as Jesus' hearers are coming to terms with that statement, Jesus gives them a detailed timeline for the next 14 days. A detailed prediction of his death. It's the third time that Jesus has predicted his death, and it is the most detailed. We'll just for the moment come back and look at the first two with me, the first two predictions. Come back to Matthew chapter 16. Matthew chapter 16, I'm going to run through here the things he says. This is the first time in the life of Jesus that he's actually telling them he's going to die. Matthew 16, sentence 21. From that time on, 21, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things in the hands of the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. That's the first prediction. And a few days later, there's the second prediction. It's Matthew 17, sentence 22. And you see there is Jesus, 22, Matthew 17, when they came together in Galilee, he said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They'll kill him, and on the third day he'll be raised to life." The disciples, they're filled with grief. And this third prediction, we get even more detail. Flick forward to the third prediction, Matthew 20, 17, and you just see how Jesus is building on the things said in the first two predictions. Matthew 20, 17, as Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside and said to him, "We're going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They'll condemn him to death and turn him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. And on the third day, he'll be raised to life." Now, let me work through that in detail. Here we are on the main game. Matthew 20, 17. Jesus is heading to Jerusalem, takes the 12 disciples aside. It's a private conversation. I take it that's because the 12, of all the people, they're the ones who are just even remotely ready to cope with this news, this devastating news. Probably the conversation took place around Jericho, 25k out of Jerusalem. And you get that from verse 29. They're in Jericho. Imagine you're there listening. Imagine you're one of the 12. And the first thing we read is that in the next 14 days, Jesus will face betrayal. See, we're going up to Jerusalem, 18. And the Son of Man will be betrayed, handed over. Betrayed. I mean, you just picture it. You're there in the group. There's 12 of you, and he says, "I'm going to be betrayed." Well, you're looking around. Is it you? Is it you? Is it you? Who's going to betray? But when he's betrayed, he's going to be handed over. Handed over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. I mean, just imagine you're a Jew. And you've grown up in your fishing boat, and you've grown up out in the scrub, and you've just heard of the Jerusalem temple. And you've always respected the Jerusalem temple, and you've always respected the leadership of the Jerusalem temple. And he says, "What's going to happen is we're going up to Jerusalem, and I'm going to be betrayed to the chief priests, to the teachers of the law. I'm going to be betrayed to the temple leadership, to the temple executive." Now, that's new information to his followers. I mean, he's told them before he was going to be killed, but I mean, maybe he was going to be assassinated, maybe he was going to be stuck in the side of the chest with a knife, I don't know. But he's actually saying it's going to be the whole temple leadership of Judaism that takes him on. They will condemn him to death. He says, "I'm going to be killed not by some kind of unlawful lynching. I'm going to be killed by an exercise of judicial power." If you're reading through Matthew's Gospel, that's the first time that's been made public. How would you feel if you're one of the fishermen? All your life you've grown up with this picture of the temple as the centre of everything, and you're on a pilgrimage to that temple, and Jesus says, "When we get there, the heavies of the temple, they're going to kill me." And then Jesus says another piece of new information. They'll condemn him to death and turn him over to the Gentiles. We're working within Judaism. Jerusalem is a fire. And the government over everything in the Roman Empire is, well, it's Roman. And so the Jewish chief priests and the teachers of the law, they've got moral authority, they've got religious authority, but they don't have civil authority. For there to be a death sentence, they've actually got to say, they've got to pass somebody over to the people who can do the execution. They've got to pass somebody over to the Romans. Now that is another bombshell for the follower of Jesus. I mean, it's not, you just picture you're the one. You just picture one of the 12. And it's not just that you're going with Jesus and you're now going to take on the temple of God. You're going with Jesus and you're going to take on the empire of Rome. We thought we were going to Jerusalem for a Passover party. And we're going to Jerusalem for my death. Now, theologically, 2 points flow from here. The first is that Jews and Gentiles are involved in the execution of Jesus. The whole world is responsible for his death. I mean, the Jew is more responsible in a sense because they've had the promises, they've had the predictions, and they've misunderstood it or they've rejected it. But the Gentiles are implicated. That's the first theological point. The second theological point there is every time God judges his people, the Jews, back in the Old Testament, every time the people of God do the wrong thing, God hands them over to the Gentiles. How does that spell out? I'll give you a couple of verses from back earlier in the Bible. If you want to come back to Leviticus 26, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus chapter 26 and sentence 33. God speaking to his people says, if you do the wrong thing, this is what's going to happen. I will scatter you among the nations and will draw out my sword and pursue you. Your land will be laid waste and your cities will lie in ruins. You do the wrong thing, I'll scatter you among the nations. Or down a couple of sentences, you do the wrong thing, 38, and you will perish among the nations. You do the wrong thing, says God, I'm going to give you over to the nations. You might just want to jot this down, but you see the same thing in Psalm 106:41, he handed them over to the nations, and their foes ruled over them. And so deep in the Jewish psyche, to be handed over to the nations is to be judged by God. Next thing that Jesus warns his disciples about that he's going to face in the next 14 days is humiliation. He says he's going to be, back to Matthew 20, two sentences, so much power. He's going to be mocked. They'll turn him over to the Gentiles to be mocked, ridiculed. A friend of mine in his late 80s was up at a convention during the week in the mountains, and he had significant kidney problems and had to be raced to hospital. And taken to hospital in the mountains late at night. And our friend who took him to hospital says perhaps he was a bit vague when he was being interviewed by the doctor in casualty. But he had trouble answering the doctor's questions, and this man is a businessman. He's 87, he's built up a business, he's got 30 or 40 people working for him, still. And he still goes into work a couple of hours every day. He's an astute man. He's a powerful figure. But late at night in a hospital room, my friend said the young doctor in casualty was just disrespectful and patronising and mocking. No idea of the man she was talking to. But it is one thing for a young doctor in the Blue Mountains to ridicule a man in Australia. It's a completely another thing again for a soldier to ridicule the Christ of God. He's going to be spat at. He's going to be jeered. He's going to be mocked. He's going to have a crown of thorns put on his head. Jesus is, they've called him Lord. They've seen him walk on water. They've seen him feed 5,000. And he says, I'm going to be mocked. But next bombshell, flogged and crucified. We, in hindsight, are very familiar with the idea that Jesus would be crucified. But if you're reading through Matthew's Gospel, this is the first time that crucifixion has been mentioned. Yes, there have been lines like, take up your cross and follow me, but that's kind of a metaphor. This is the first time that Jesus has said, I am going to die by crucifixion. And if you were one of the 12 hanging with Jesus at that point, and he's gathered you round on that dusty road 25k out of Jerusalem, and what would you think? It would have sent shivers down the spine of the 12 listening to him then. He's not talking about being executed quickly. I mean, Saddam Hussein has been killed by hanging. What other ways do people get killed these days when it's state-sponsored execution? Well, there's lethal injection in some parts of the world. There's having your head chopped off in some parts of the world. There's being shot by the firing squad in some parts of the world. They are tame. They are gentle. They are nothing compared to crucifixion. Crucifixion is the most barbarous form of killing ever invented. You could hang on a cross for a week and then die of exhaustion. I mean, the Medes, the Persians, they invented it, but the Romans turned it into an art. All sorts of methods of crucifixion. You could be crucified upside down. You could be crucified with your arms just up like that. You'd be crucified with your private parts impaled. All sorts of variations that the Romans invented. And I take it the 12 followers of Jesus, as they're sitting by the side of the road, listening to him spell out the next 14 days, thinking, not just killed, but crucified. Our Lord suffering on that instrument of torture reserved for the most basest of criminals. Do you know Roman nobility never got crucified? It was only the slaves, the insurrectionists, the... When Jesus comes to be crucified, it wasn't that there was an accident that day. It wasn't that he was just walking through Jerusalem and Pilate's having a bad day, looks out the window and says, you. No, Jesus came on a mission to be betrayed to the chief priests, teachers of the law, to be handed over to the Gentiles, to be mocked, to be flogged, to be crucified. Why did Jesus have this mission? Well, the man asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Jesus said to him, keep the commandments. Back to chapter 19. Chapter 19, sentence 18. Keep the commandments. If you want to enter life, obey the commandments. Which ones? The man inquired. Jesus replied, do not murder, do not commit adultery, do not steal, do not give false testimony, honour your father and mother, love your neighbour as yourself. I mean, that's only half the commandments, but how do you go? I do the little check on me. I start with the bottom one, love your neighbour as yourself. No, I haven't. Honour your father and mother. I've got good parents, but I haven't honoured them consistently. You shall not bear false witness. Don't tell lies. And I have. you shall not steal. And I have. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. I've not touched a woman inappropriately since I've been married. But my eyes have gone places that I wish they hadn't. And my heart has gone places that I wish it hadn't. And murder? I've not killed a man. But there have been moments of anger, of fury, of hate, of rage. And I thought, where has that come from? I look at this list of what God expects and I see I haven't achieved it, that I can't achieve it, and you can't either. I cannot please my Father. And so the justice of God would demand that I be unacceptable to Him. But then last Sunday, we saw that incredible story, that amazing story, where the Father set people to work. And then, rather than give them what they deserve, He was generous. Richly, extraordinarily generous. He doesn't treat me with justice. God goes way beyond justice to generosity. Way beyond what I deserve. And in that context, Jesus spells out His mission. Jesus says, "My Father sent me to die, to be handed over by a friend, to be betrayed, to be unjustly condemned by the chief priests and the scribes, to be handed over to the Gentiles, to be mocked, to be flogged, to be crucified." Why? What motivated Jesus to come this way? We can see that it was the Father's generosity, but how did it work? How did it look down to 28? Jesus speaking, "Even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give His life as a ransom for many." I don't know if you've been following the news in the media this week, but 9 South Korean oil workers have been abducted by gunmen in Nigeria. It happened on Wednesday. The 9 worked for Daewoo, and gunmen in 6 boats invaded the oil services base in southern Nigeria, and they blew up part of the office building and captured the 9 South Korean oil workers. And in the last 12 months, I didn't know this, I'm not an expert on southern Nigerian delta politics and crime issues, but in the last 12 months, more than 80 foreign oil workers have been kidnapped in Nigeria. More than 80. And the news stories I read said that what has happened is this Nigerian delta region, most people there, they live in squalor. But it's one of the top oil-producing parts of the world. And the kidnappers are desperate, and most of the victims are freed after a ransom is paid. For freedom to be achieved, the regular pattern is a ransom is paid. Or a story on the wires out of America today is that 2 Americans who went to a wedding reception on the Mexican border were kidnapped and freed after $20,000 bail was paid, a ransom was paid. Hear Jesus on this. We're stuck. We're in a fix. We're in trouble before God. We're unacceptable before God. We cannot help ourselves. And Jesus' mission is to pay the ransom. God does not treat us justly like we deserve. God moves from over justice to overflowing generosity, and Jesus comes from God on this mission to be crucified, and the purpose of Jesus being crucified was to pay the ransom, to give his life as a ransom for many. And then Jesus says, on the third day, I will be raised to life. Why did he rise? God raised Jesus to show that he'd accepted his son. God raised Jesus because Jesus himself had no sin and could not be allowed to see decay. God raised Jesus to so Jesus could testify of our salvation. God raised Jesus as Lord, as ruler, as judge. And Jesus just drops it on them. By the side of the road, 25k out of Jerusalem, they're just walking along and he says, here's what's happening the next 14 days. How would you react? 3rd time Jesus has gone through this prediction, but so much more detail this time. I'm a journalist, I like looking for reaction, I like checking things out, and really what I've got to say is somebody who looks for reaction when you see significant events, frankly, the reaction is disappointing. I mean, look what happens straight afterwards, verse 20. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and kneeling down asked a favour of him. What is it you want, he asked. She said, grant that one of these 2 sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom. Mrs. Zebedee, what were you thinking? I mean, was she not listening at all? I take it she hasn't taken anything out of what he spelled out in detail of what's going to happen in the next 14 days. I mean, it's not like Jesus has said, I'll tell you what I've got to do the next 14 days. I've got to go and find a venue at Piemont. I've got to organise some spreadsheets. I've got to do some work on some budgets. I've got to get in contact with some councillors from Leichhardt Council. I've got to give 3 talks in Wollongong. Wouldn't make any difference if I didn't do any of that. Jesus has announced that the next 14 days will change the world forever. And she completely misses it and just goes on without a feather bed for her sons. Do not be like Mrs. Zebedee. Whatever you do in coming to church tonight, do not be Mrs. Zebedee. Do not just think, oh, well, I've heard what Jesus is going to do that 14 days in April in the year 33, and I'll just sort of go on talking about the next thing. I mean, I've got to say, it probably is the case. There'll be people here tonight at church who've come to church tonight with the intention of being Mrs. Zebedee. I mean, you didn't expect your life to change today. You don't need to come and hear a talk and then go on as if you hadn't even heard it, as if you didn't even know he was going to do this fortnight of stuff. If anything I've said has even touched the slightest chord tonight, and I guess I'm saying this to the person who has not thought deeply about relationship with God before, can I urge you to do our end of the month Introducing God course? It's a course we've got starting up in a couple of weeks, 3 weeks' time, and it's an opportunity to work through in a lounge room context, over a meal, finding out what it would look like to have a relationship with God, to put your thoughts forward, to hear some others' thoughts, to get a bit of input. But this is so important. This is not like anyone else's 14 days. This is so important that we need to stop, take time, look at it and think about it. But I take it even tonight there's somebody here and you're thinking, yeah, well, Dominic, that's fine. I'd like to do that course. That'd be good to do that course. And look, I'll indicate on the welcome card that I'd like to do the course. But actually, I'm ready to close with God tonight. I never realised that Jesus did that for me. I never realised that he opened the door for me. That he opened the door that otherwise would have stayed closed. And I never realised what it cost him. How would you respond to Jesus at this point? What you'd do is pray. You'd respond to Jesus by praying, by saying, God, I recognise that you are God, that you made the world, but that I have not lived as if you are God. I've failed you, I've let you down, I've rebelled against you. Thank you that you do not treat me justly, but with generosity. Thank you that Jesus came to be mocked, whipped, and crucified for me. Thank you that he gave his life as a ransom for me. Thank you that you raised him from the dead. Well, if that's you, if that's where you're at tonight, well, why don't we pray? I'll pray, and if you'd like to pray with me, let's do that together. Dear God, thank you that you made the world. I'm sorry that I've not lived as if you are God, that I've rejected you and failed you. Thank you that you do not treat me with justice but with generosity. Lord, thank you that Jesus came on this mission to be mocked, whipped, and crucified. Thank you that he gave his life as a ransom for many, for me. Please help me to live now with Jesus as my Lord in the power of your Spirit. Amen. Can I just say that if you prayed that prayer with me, and you know that you prayed that prayer with me, and you know that whatever else was going on in anybody else's heart tonight, that you were fixing things up with God, can I just say that God has heard you, that he's listened to you, and that you've come home and you're back in secure relationship with him, and that is wonderful. And we exist as a church to get help to you. We'll open for questions, but can I ask you, while we do the question time, can I ask you to fill in our little visitor's card? I'm going to ask everyone tonight to fill in this visitor's card so that nobody feels uncomfortable at this point, as if they're being singled out for it, just so that nobody is the one person in the row who feels like, I want to fill in the card, but I don't want to be the only person filling in the card. And you'll see there on the right-hand side, I'd like to know more about an Introducing God course. And if you tick that, well, we will invite you to one of these Introducing God courses. You don't have to come, you can change your mind, of course, but we'll let you know about the details. But you may like to know anything else about this church. I'm new to this church. I want to make this church my home. You'd like to know more about a small group, or we're starting a new members course in a couple of weeks' time for people who want to join up as members of this church. Anything that you'd want to be involved in to do with Christians in the media, or if you've got a comment to make about tonight, you could put that on the card and we'll collect them in our next song. But do you want to ask a question or make a comment while those cards are being filled in? Sure, Guy. Guy is challenging whether or not I have been fair on Mrs. Zebedee in verse 20. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons, he's saying maybe there was an indefinite amount of time between the end of verse 19 and the beginning of verse 20. Maybe, but it was rhetorically a good point. Sam. How did I work out it was 14 days? Well, it's Palm Sunday at the beginning of chapter 21. And so that's the triumphal entry to to Jerusalem. And so I'm just assuming that we're a couple of days. We're within a week between a few days of Palm Sunday, because we're only about 15 verses before Palm Sunday. And also Jericho is the last stop heading into Jerusalem. So I can't imagine it took more than a week. Yeah. But it is interesting to see. I mean, I think we might have the picture that these events took place on over a lot longer period of time than they actually did. I think we're moving pretty fast at this point. And you notice that in the Gospel accounts, often in each of the Gospels, you've got kind of two-thirds of introduction spread over 2 years, and then the last third all happens in a week. And so it really speeds up in the action as we get to this point in the Gospel account. Yeah. Sure. Why does Jesus refer to himself as the Son of Man rather than just saying I? Son of Man is an enigmatic saying, a statement designed to be a little ambiguous, a little intriguing. It could mean three things. It could mean, well, really any male is a son of man. You know, or any person is a son of man, just a child of a human. So it could just mean any human. It could mean me, myself. It was a term that had been sometimes used by people just to refer to one. Or you might have heard that the Queen refers to herself about one does wish one's children would keep their marital affairs in better order. Do you know, you can hear the Queen making statements like that. Well, in private, of course, she would make a statement like that. The third term, or third way the term Son of Man is used, is in Daniel chapter 7. And this is an extraordinary verse. But Daniel chapter 7, Ezekiel and Daniel, and verse about 13 or 14. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. And so Daniel 7 speaks of a son of man, or one called a son of man, who will be the world's super ruler. And so Jesus uses this term, son of man, and you're supposed to, each time you see it, you're supposed to ask, oh, is he talking about any old human? Is he talking about himself, or is he talking about the super ruler? And it's quite an interesting exercise, and you might want to do this. This is one of the things I like doing in my personal Bible study, chasing up little ideas like this. But if somebody reads the Bible each day, and it's a great thing to do, just to read through Matthew's Gospel and find all the references to Son of Man and say, is this the world super ruler from Daniel 7, or is this myself, or is this any old person? And which one are they understanding him as saying that at that point? So I think it is his consistent term to describe himself, and he uses it to be deliberately ambiguous, but so that in hindsight, when we look back, we can see that he was actually hinting that he was the world super ruler from Daniel 7 all along. That's how I've taken it. Bruce. Bruce is asking, or making the suggestion, weren't there hundreds of disciples and 12 apostles? I could stand corrected on this, but I think in the Gospels they're called disciples. I don't think they're called apostles until we get to Acts. That's my memory. And so within the group of zillions of disciples, there were a particular 12 who were the ones that he particularly picked. But I think he starts calling, I think they start to be referred to when we get to the book of Acts. Yeah. Is that right, Andrew? I remembered that rightly. But predominantly the term disciple is used. Yeah, Andrew's found one verse where, in Luke 6, was it, mate? Yeah. That's a shame, my brilliant theory. Yes, look, in Luke chapter 6, verse 12, on one of those days, Jesus went out to a mountainside to pray and spent the night praying to God. When morning came, he called his disciples with him and chose 12 of them, whom he also designated apostles. But I think that still, frequently, the 12 are referred to as the disciples. Oh, no, I've just found in Luke, I'm just looking at Luke chapter 9, verse 10, when the apostles returned. Why don't I take that as homework for next week, okay, rather than flounder around up here any longer?
I'm asking the same question. I'm doubly confused now, because they replaced Judas, and Paul refers to himself as an apostle, so there must be 13 apostles, not 12 at all. And yet you never hear anyone talk about the 13 apostles.
That is true. That is true. At the point of Acts chapter 1, when Judas has clearly disqualified himself from being an apostle by betraying Jesus, a new apostle is chosen by lot, and that is Matthias, the patron saint of gambling. And Matthias is chosen, and then you have 12 apostles, and that builds the symmetry that you had. Why do you need 12 apostles at that point? Because we're establishing a new people of God. We had the 12 tribes of Israel. God called a people and with 12 leaders, the 12 tribes of Israel, and then the new people of God, the new Jewish people of God, is constituted, is that a word? Yeah. Headed up by the 12 apostles, but they're the 12 apostles who are sent to the Jews. It's some years later that the Apostle Paul is called, and as a special apostle, given the role as the one who would bring the gospel of Jesus to Gentiles. And so he is separate and marked not for the Jews, but for the Gentiles. And I thank God that he was, because I'm a Gentile. And so he's my apostle, the one sent to bring the gospel to me. Yeah. Jasper, if you read, let's see if I've got your question, if you read Daniel 7 with the picture that the Son of Man was going to be a massive, amazing ruler, is Mrs. Zebedee's request not too unreasonable when you think that she might be on the train of ruler, power, glory? When you read the logic, did I get your question, Jasper? Yeah. When you read the logic of the rich young man, the rich young man, he's a powerful guy. And so you think if anyone's going to be blessed, he's going to get the blessing. But no, he goes away. Jesus says at the renewal of all things, verse 28, the Son of Man sits on his glorious throne. You who followed me will sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. He really is speaking of glory there. Everyone who's left fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters will receive 100 times as much, will inherit eternal life. But many who are first will be last, and the last first. And so, actually, I've jumped a verse. They thought blessing went to the rich. Peter says, verse 27, we've left everything to follow you. What will there be for us then? What then will there be for us? Jesus says, you who've left everything, you'll be rewarded. But many who are first will be last. Many who are last will be first. Now, you could even read that you will be rewarded even greater because you were the last. You were the ones who've just snuck in now. Or you could just be saying, as I said last week, it's blessing, it's generosity, but it's with a twist. And then you just saw this, I'm generous, I'm generous, I'm generous, I'm generous, thumped through the first part of chapter 20. And then I think Mrs. Zebedee comes and says, make sure my son's right at the centre of it. And I think she's missed the heart of what, I mean, to come back to Guy, I think she does deserve a hard deal, because I think she's missed the heart of what he's on about. From the whole last chapter, really. Because he's saying, I'm just pouring out the generosity. And the rude person says, well, make sure I'm at the front of the queue. And that seems to be the tone of what she's doing. She's saying, I want my boys to be at the front to make sure they get the most. Whereas that, and he goes on to say, verse 26, not so with you. Don't be the one trying to push forward to get to the front. Whoever wants to be great must be the servant. Must be the putting the others' interests first. So the way to be great in the kingdom of heaven is not to be jumping to the front of the queue. The way to be great in the kingdom of heaven is to be looking after the other person. Hayden. What is the relationship between 17 to 19 and the first part of chapter 20? I think it's just that we've seen God's extraordinary generosity. Now, how does he bring it about? By his son dying. That's as good as I can go. Yeah.